Hi there. My name is Dan Kilbride. I'm the host of New Books in American Studies, and I'm also the chair of the history department at John Carroll University outside of Cleveland, Ohio. Today, we're talking with Lauren Coodley. She's an emeritus professor from Napa Community College in California, and she's the author of, among other books, Upton Sinclair, California Socialist, Celebrity Intellectual, published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2013. Everybody out there with the pulse knows the name Upton Sinclair. If you took an American history class at some point in your life, you know that he's the author of The Jungle and one of the foremost muckraking journalists of the late progressive era in the United States. But Upton Sinclair was a lot more than that. He was, as the subtitle says, he was a socialist. He was an intellectual. He was an author of many, many more books than The Jungle. He was involved in Hollywood. He wrote plays. And he lived a long and very interesting life. So this little biography is very timely and very interesting. So Lauren Coodley, welcome to New Books in American Studies.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for your interest in my work.
You bet. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write about Upton Sinclair?
Okay. Well, I began teaching in the late 70s, and at that point, the field of women's history was kind of in the process of being invented, and I did not at that time even have a degree in history, but the community college was flexible enough to allow me to develop the first course in women's history in the late 70s. I eventually went on to get a master's in history about 20 years later. But while I, during those 30 or 35 years that I taught, you know, what I was developing as an early American women's history course, you know, I had a lot of young men in the class who were very enthusiastic participants. And occasionally one of them would say wistfully, well, you know, where are the interesting men that we've never learned about? These women are great, but, like, why do we always hear just about the same men in U.S. history? Well, you know, are there other kinds of heroes, other kinds of people that we could look to as models? Because they saw the young women in the class really being very inspired by, you know, some of the unknown women, who, ironically, all the same women that I taught about in 20th century women's history were the turned out to be personal friends with Upton Sinclair, something that I had no idea at the time that, you know, I started this research. So anyway, I got that question. It was pretty poignant. I started a file on men who were involved in the struggle for equal rights that I would occasionally drop things in the file. And somewhere in the early 90s, I came across a movie on Upton Sinclair's campaign for governor in California, what was called the Epic Campaign to End Poverty in California. There is a wonderful film that was made about it in the early 90s, and a book as well, Campaign of the Century by Greg Mitchell. So then I had this big aha moment because I was just starting to, you know, prepare to go back to school to get my master's in history and to teach California history. And I thought, I was born here, I went to school here, and I never heard about this campaign. Really? How is it that I never heard about Upton Sinclair in California? I knew what most people knew. He wrote The Jungle, period. So I started trying to figure this out, and I discovered there hadn't been a biography since 1975, and I wrote my master's thesis as an argument for why there should be a new biography. So all the ingredients were in place in 1995 when I finished my master's thesis. In other words, I knew what should be in the biography. I didn't have the chance to write it until I retired in 2010, but I laid all the groundwork and did all the research as part of my master's thesis. I hope that helps.
It's always interesting to hear the trajectory.
Yeah.
That somebody takes.
Yeah, you know,
towards
every time I tell the story a little differently, but this is the story for today.
You know, one of the things, and you kind of alluded to this in your explanation for how you came upon Upton Sinclair, and that was that Upton, your book really makes clear that Upton Sinclair was somebody who was very comfortable in the company of women, very influenced by women, not afraid to admit that he was influenced by women. Do you think, and also that he was a an active feminist, an activist in the women's rights movement. Did being identified with so-called women's causes, not only feminism, but also prohibition and temperance, did it hurt him in his other advocacies?
That's such a perceptive question. I think it laid the groundwork for the caricature of him that began to be developed, as you know, if you read my book, the whole thing about red-blooded men and the rhetoric that was introduced by actually Theodore Roosevelt and then carried forth by the publisher of the L.A. Times, Otis Chandler. I'm sure you've seen that. That quote, that incredible quote about this effeminate, you know, man with his high voice, you know, speaking to women, this perverted creature. Yeah, it gave the people who already wanted to go after him a lot of ammunition. I mean, it's very akin to the way that, you know, Democratic politicians always seem to get, you know, there's what they call the wimp factor. They get feminized, they get ridiculed for not being masculine enough. You know, even in today, where Chris Christie's being defended by some people on Fox who say, you know, he's a he-man and America doesn't want he-men anymore. I don't know if you know that, but that's, I am always watching sure. for these kind of discourses.
But so in what ways do you think was he able to overcome that in his life? I mean, one of the striking images, for example, of in your book is of Upton Sinclair playing tennis. He seems like a pretty athletic guy, at least in that picture. Was he able to rebut that charge that he was some kind of unmanly man?
Oh yeah, I don't think it ever bothered him at all. He probably thought it was funny. What distressed me was that it persisted in biographical and bibliographical references to him post. Humorously, after he died, I found that there was this thread of derision and contempt. I mean, he was listed in a book called Zanies as, you know, some kind of almost like a circus freak. And that was kind of why I wanted to reclaim him, because I felt with the new histories of masculinity, there were ways to understand him that hadn't been available to previous biographers. I tried to do that without using a lot of jargon in my book.
Yeah, we appreciate it because you could have easily done that.
Yeah.
He had an interesting childhood. Grew up spent his early years in a boarding house in Baltimore. Had a very ambivalent, and you can maybe expand on that, ambivalent relationship with his father anyway. How did growing up in a Baltimore boarding house influence him?
You know, what I discovered when I was doing the research for this book, because I hadn't researched his childhood when I did my master's thesis in the 90s, I really had to immerse myself in Baltimore history, for example, which I realized was the history of the post-Civil War period, which I realized was about the failure of the Confederacy and the effect that it had on people like his parents. And I saw from some of your work that's kind of your field, so I'm sure you would have a lot more to say about it than me, but I tried my best to understand it. So I'd say that Baltimore was in a very particular situation in relationship to the post-Civil War period, but as he would say, poverty and alcoholism were the dominant aspects of his childhood. He was very much like many children of alcoholics who, you know, today would be in a, you know, the Al-Anon, you know, they would be going to Al-Anon meetings and getting support from other children of alcoholics. Such a thing didn't exist. In fact, people in the 19th century were more likely to construct a political analysis and become politically active rather than go to support groups like people do today. So, yeah, he was influenced by living among a group of people who had been very sympathetic to the Confederacy, but I would say that the dominant influence was really, I think he adored his father, but seeing his father, you know, drink away the family savings and having to be evicted over and over again and living in the same room as his parents.
Yeah.
And not having siblings, probably because of all this, was he says it was the most dominant experience of his life, alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, eventually, as you point out, he moves to New York. Again, it's sort of a one-room tenement with his parents. It seems to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that he had a very, how should I say this? I'm not sure that he was as so much educated as he was self-educated. For example, you suggest that, you know, he went to Columbia, but he took a very unconventional track of study at Columbia. He kind of saw it as almost like a buffet line, sort of a little bit of this, a little bit of that, didn't really finish many classes. What do you think he got out of his formal education, and how did it shape him, positively or negatively?
Well, you know, that's such a good question, and I love speaking to somebody who's read the book so thoughtfully as you have. I will say that of all the things I identify with Upton Sinclair, it's probably his experience with higher ed that most expresses, you know, my own take. I went to Berkeley, and, you know, mm-hmm. I sort of also had that buffet cafeteria approach of, you know, popping in and out, never quite finding what I was looking for in mm-hmm. class, educating myself on my own. I dropped out of college and then went back. He had a very, very similar experience. He taught himself several languages, which I did not manage to do. But he was, you know, he was, should I say, he was really looking for the kind of teacher that he only found in Edward McDowell, his music teacher. Someone
yeah.
that he
mm-hmm.
could get a personal mentorship and personal inspiration and personal attention from, which it really isn't possible at a large university. I was fortunate enough to find a mentor at Berkeley eventually, and that's how I finished. And I suspect that Edward McDowell was like that for him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I will talk later.
You know.
Right, and we'll talk later on about his one of his many reforms that Sinclair was interested in was education.
Mm-hmm.
One of the, you know, this book sort of moves back and forth between his personal life, his professional life, his political activism, and so forth, although there was a lot of intersection between those things. And one of the intersections between his personal life and his political activities was his first marriage, which you suggest really foundered on the issue of birth control, and it's something that, you know, he became an advocate of. Can you just tell the readers, you know, the listeners who haven't read the book about his first marriage and sort of the complex attraction that he and his first wife Meta had. And also, there are problems with, you know, celibacy and birth control.
Yeah, it's interesting because his other biographers never really went beyond that first marriage in their analysis of his love life. I tried to, take his second and his third marriages as well as his one documented love affair. You know, look at them as fully as other biographers had looked at his first marriage. But in any case, his first marriage always intrigues people because his wife was obviously very beautiful, very sexy. They were very young when they got together, about 19 and 20, probably both virgins. They were passionately in love. She got pregnant almost immediately. And Upton Sinclair had at that moment decided that he was sick of being a hack writer and that he was mm-hmm. willing to be very poor and write seriously. So it's the terrible, terrible timing that right when he was giving up this guaranteed income he had, as you know, he wrote for popular fiction, for magazines. He wrote adventure stories.
Mm-hmm.
He was prolific and it was profitable. But he was sickening by it. I mean, he had dreamed of being like another Shelley, and he couldn't bear the grind of thinking that that's all he would be. It's like, you know, in the 50s, somebody that goes into advertising and then just can't take it anymore by, you know, 1965. So for him, he'd had it. He wanted to do serious work, and his wife was pregnant. They had the child. it was a difficult birth, it was a difficult infancy, and he told her that they could not continue to have sexual intimacy because they were refused birth control, and they really didn't know what how to access birth control. This was about 1903.
Mm-hmm.
It really, there wasn't much, and they weren't able to get hold of any. So she, you know, they're living in a little isolated cabin.
Or tents sometimes.
Yeah,
I mean,
tents,
they lived
in tents on the Thousand Islands of New York, and sometimes in a cabin in New Jersey. And they gave way to temptation sometimes. They tried not to. It was a lot of bitterness between them. And eventually she took other lovers, I think, before he did. Eventually they both had other lovers, and finally they got a divorce. But it was, you're absolutely right. If there had been birth control, they might have stayed together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You referenced one time when Sinclair walked in, and as you point out, you know, Meta kind of let herself go for a time,
not taking care of herself. The suicidal.
Yeah, I mean, did she actually have a suicide attempt, or did he just kind of walk into her while she was kind of fingering this pistol? And was there an attempt, or was there?
Well,
she was always
a very self-dramatizing woman. She married twice more, and I've seen a little bit about the writing that she tried to do. She was a woman who kind of, you know, she was her own drama. She carried a lot of drama with her. She wasn't able to write about it because she was so full of it. So, yeah, I think she was sort of putting on an act. I mean, I think it was semi-serious, but I don't think she probably would have gone through with it, but, you know, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How did Upton Sinclair become a socialist?
Okay. Well, actually, and that happened right before he met Meta. He was trying to figure out, he had always been trying to figure out the why, the nature of existence.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so troubled by the difference between rich and poor, because his mother's relatives were very wealthy. And yet, you know, he saw the way people lived in boarding houses. So he went back and forth. He called it a Cinderella childhood, going back and forth, back and forth.
Mm.
And like many children of alcoholics, you know, he's trying to look for maybe a theological explanation for the alcoholism, his father's alcoholism. But he did kind of give up on organized religion by the time he was about 14 or 15. So he was just searching for meaning. I mean, he found it in Emerson, and Thoreau, and Shelley, in the poets. But he also wanted a sort of a social explanation of why the world was the way it was. And he was befriended by some young socialists, not to be confused with communists, and I mm-hmm. assume your listeners know that there was a very active socialist party in the U.S. in the early 20th century, which advocated electoral politics and a more equitable redistribution of wealth. So he met a few people. He read some of their work. He went to a dinner party with them. And one of them, George Abbott, gave him enough money to do his first novel, Manassas, his first serious novel, his Civil War novel. So in a sense, he was befriended by some very thoughtful, sincere, and eloquent young men who were socialists, and I think he, you know, it all made sense to him. Henry George had laid the foundation for that kind of thinking,
mm-hmm.
There was just a lot of people trying to figure out, amid the Gilded Age, wealth and poverty issues. Socialism offered an analysis that was very attractive
mm-hmm.
To many, you know, young people trying to coming of age in that early 20th century.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, Manassas was his first sort of a serious book. And I should observe here that he wrote just under 80 books. Is that right?
Yeah.
In his lifetime?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the one that was the first big success and the one that, of course, we know him for is The Jungle. And I wondered if you could address, you know, how he came to get that assignment mm-hmm. and to write the book, and also how he responded to the way the book was received. Because, as you point out, the book was not received in the way that he quite expected. He, I think, and I may be misquoting him here, but he says something like he was aiming for people's hearts and he hit their stomachs instead.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you could kind of mm-hmm. take us through the research and the writing and the publication of The Jungle.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to do that. I just want to say parenthetically that I'm the first historian that's written about him. Or I might be the second. But generally, he's been claimed by, you know, as a writer who perhaps had wrote too prolifically and not always as well as mm-hmm. he could have. I am really happy that you, as a historian, have chosen to interview me, because I think he's best seen as a figure in American history, as opposed mm-hmm. to trying to rank him among American writers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think what he's done is important historically as opposed to literarily. So that,
well,
that
strange you say that, because
my book.
Yeah, I mean, he does appear in every single American history textbook that's been published since, you know, 1940, I think. It's strange that he's been claimed, as you say, by literary critics. Not that there's anything wrong with those people, mm-hmm. but you'd think that historians would see him as an appropriate historical subject.
Yeah, well, he wrote The Jungle not because he was passionately interested in slaughterhouses or food, although he was later on very interested in food issues, but he wrote it because he was a socialist, and he had been hearing about this unsuccessful strike of slaughterhouse workers. He'd been reading about it in Appeal to Reason, which is like what we would call an underground newspaper, alternative mm-hmm. newspaper of that time. And the editor offered him some money to go live there in Chicago and figure out how way to write about life in the slaughterhouse. So he went and lived there for 6 weeks, left his wife and child in the New Jersey farmhouse, lived in workers' homes, carried a lunch pail. Essentially, he went underground, although they wouldn't have called it that then. You know, he just sort of mm-hmm. fit in. The workers were Eastern European. He didn't look that different from them, I guess. Maybe he changed his clothes a little bit. But the slaughterhouse owners never noticed him. So he was able to make some very, very accurate observations. He took tons of notes, went back to the farmhouse, wrote it. Actually, it was serialized as a series of articles for the Appeal to Reason. And then a couple publishers were interested in publishing it as a novel. And as you know, that was a tangled story. Some people weren't, you know, said they were interested and then backed off. And eventually it was mm-hmm. published. And it was a huge success. And he said, as you point out, I aimed for their hearts and I hit their stomachs. So he was trying to write the book because he was concerned about the treatment of workers in slaughterhouses particularly. And he knew about that because he'd, again, been reading accounts in Appeal to Reason about this unsuccessful strike of 1904. He thought people needed to know how badly these workers were treated, that it would affect them. Jack London said he tried to write the Uncle Tom's Cabin of wage slavery in the jungle. So that's what he very consciously was trying to do, because he was really impressed with how Harriet Beecher Stowe had affected the conscience of the country mm-hmm. with her, you know, with her mm-hmm. work, Uncle Tom's Cabin. But what it turned out is that because the product was something that was consumed by Americans, for instance, it wasn't a clothing factory, it was a food factory.
Yeah.
People mostly were appalled at realizing what was in what they ate.
Yeah.
And so he very much affected people. People forever have felt that meat was safer because of Upton Sinclair, and yet that was really not his intention at all.
Mm-hmm. What did you, well, let me step back here. One of the takeaways of The Jungle was the progressive reform movement, things like the Food and Drug Act and everything people read about in, you know, American history textbooks regarding the administration of Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft and so forth. As you say, he was a socialist, not a revolutionary socialist, but you know, someone who was willing to work through the system. What did he think of the way that his book led to progressive reform under the umbrella of capitalism, but not socialist change? Was he disappointed that his book wasn't more of a revolutionary instrument and more of one that promoted reform?
I don't think so. I think that although he wished that things had gone farther, I found it fascinating that he thought there should be municipal slaughterhouses, that they should be, in a sense, nationalized or provided by the government so that there could be no profit and that, you know, it's sort of like the argument about the public option in healthcare. He wanted it to be run by the government. He thought that, that our food was so important that it shouldn't be a private company that was in charge. I thought that was a fascinating concept. I'd never thought about that. But I think, you know, he was probably very, very gratified that some progress was made. And I don't think he ever felt that his efforts had been in vain or that it was just, you know, a capitalist accommodation. Mm-hmm. I think he just felt like, you know, there was such a ferment of people, you know, working to make change, whether it was, you know, suffrage or temperance or food safety or public health. You know, there was just a swirl of people working together that did really amazing things in the early 20th century.
Yeah.
That we're still benefiting from.
One of the other, and he was involved in many reforms, but since we're talking about food, one of his other interests was in the popular health movement.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is an old one in American history, going back to Sylvester Graham
mm-hmm.
in the first half of the 19th century. And I think you mentioned there's sort of an intersection here with T.C. Boyle's novel. I'm just losing it right now. I can't remember what the book is called. But
The
Road to Wellville. Thank you. And the film, of course. How did Sinclair become interested in this movement, and what did he recommend that Americans eat and not eat? Because mm-hmm. this is sort of an era in which, you know, it's not exactly pre-scientific, but the science of nutrition was kind of in its infancy at this point. And where did he pick off from where other reformers had begun?
Well, that's a great question, and I find it one of the ways in which Sinclair, I think, is incredibly either prophetic or relevant today, because there's so much attention to food studies, food history, and the politics of food today. It's almost reminiscent of back then. I mean, people who were vegans in that era were common, right? Or people who were doing paleo diets, like people are today, were common. People were experimenting with the connections between, you know, health and diet. There were many kinds of experimental projects, like Battle Creek Sanitarium that was run by William Kellogg, and that's where, of course, he met his second wife, Mary Craig. He tried a ton of diets over the years. He wrote a book called The Book of Life in 1920 to try to help his readers understand how to live. He wrote an article called My Life and Diet, which I reprinted in my earlier book. I don't know if you know, I edited a collection of Upton Sinclair's writings published by Heyday. So his conclusion about diet was not to be obsessed with it, but to find out what worked for you. I think he was very, non-judgmental. He tried a lot of odd things. By the end of his life, he was eating rice and fruit, as you know from my book, and he was a vegetarian by the end. But he tried, you know, all meat diets. He tried, you know, the Fletcher system, which was that you chew for a really long time. Okay, so why did he do all this? Because he had ill health as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Like many children who grow up in a dysfunctional household, he probably somaticized the problems and always had a stomach ache.
Mm.
Yeah. So he had what they called, you know, delicate digestion.
Right.
So he was on a quest as a young man to figure out how to eat so that he could be productive, not in pain, not have headaches, not have stomach aches, you know. And it was a very, you know, practical investigation for him. And then he wanted to share that with the, you know, his readers.
Yeah. And he really lived his convictions. I mean, as you mentioned, he got under a lot of pressure from fellow reformers, fellow socialists, you know, people like H.L. Mencken.
Mm-hmm. Who kind of made fun of him
uh-huh. for, you know, not having a drink, you know,
yep.
loosen up. And he wouldn't do it. So he seemed to be somebody who really, you know, was willing to be, you know, he had a pretty thick skin, I guess is what I'm saying. He was willing to be called a flake, to be made fun of, but, you know, not to give in.
Yeah. I think that his, you know, his abstinence is really only understandable when we think of the way that children of drug addicts or alcoholics, you know, are in our world. I mean, not to use presentism, but we know people, all of us, who have experienced the worst aspects of, you know, addiction in their parents and who are mm-hmm. just adamant about, you know, being sober because of that. So I don't think he's, you know, I don't, for some reason, people like Mencken just didn't get it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's because we've, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has developed, you know, in the 30s, and we now have a culture, a way of talking about addiction that's really different than what was common back then. Yeah. I think they probably thought then it was more of a character flaw than an illness.
It seems that way, yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about his move to California.
Okay.
Because, you know, California is in the subtitle of this book, so you at least identify him as a Californian. Why did he move to Southern California? And I guess three questions. Why did he move? Why did he love it so much? And something that struck me, why did he hang out with so many rich people? I was really shocked by that as a socialist
mm-hmm.
when he's hanging out with Henry Ford.
Mm-hmm. Henry Ford was quite a enlightened guy when they were friends. I mean, Henry Ford sent a peace ship over to try to stop World War One. You know, Henry Ford was...
Well, we'll talk about World War One
yeah.
because that's interesting too.
Yeah.
But why don't you talk about his
move to California?
Upton Sinclair becoming a Californian.
Okay, well, I'm just going to tell you and your listeners that I didn't want this title. I wanted it to be Upton Sinclair A Life. Honestly, that was the title that I chose for my book. But my publishers had a different idea for the title.
Yeah, we don't get to choose our titles.
No.
People don't know that, but I didn't choose my title either,
yeah.
even though the title that my book was chosen was better than the one I had.
Well, that's probably true for mine as well. But I already did a book about him in California, so I really mm-hmm. felt that it was redundant. But anyway, he moved to California very specifically because... he remarried. There was a custody battle over his son with Mita. His new wife either didn't want to or couldn't have children, so he had been a single parent for some years to David.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife, Mary Craig, his new wife, seemed to want some distance between, the Southern. She came up from a Mississippi planter family. She really wanted to leave Mita, the first wife, the son, her parents, the plantation, all of it. You know, she wanted a new start. He went on his own to Carmel to explore the utopian possibilities of Carmel. But in the end, they settled in Pasadena because it seemed to him that that was a place where he could be most productive. I think he liked the friendly small town atmosphere that he found in the Pasadena that era. Carmel was a little bit too, a lot of self-indulgent artists. I think he mm-hmm. kind of liked living in a town that was more of a regular town, I guess I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't, it was unique from Los Angeles. It was its own small community in the 20s when they
right.
moved there. Actually, they moved there in about 1915, 16.
Yeah, and of course, this is World War One. This is the World War One era, and the socialist movement was quite divided over the war, with many, perhaps even most, socialists opposing the war, including in Europe. You know, European socialists, saw this in sort of Marxist terms as a war of capital against capital. In which, the proletariat were taking all the bullets. Yet Sinclair supported American entry into World War One. Why did he do that?
Well, as far as I can understand it, he did it because some of his friends who were in Europe wrote him that this would be a great opportunity to overthrow the aristocracy after the war was over. I quote at least one letter along those lines to him. I think two letters that I've seen. He also supported it because some of his friends in America thought that it was a good way to get the government involved in industry, that there would be more regulation once there was a war, and the government could use its powers, as Roosevelt did during World War II, to, integrate factories and have them unionize. And John Dewey was very persuasive on that point to Sinclair about World War One. That it would, sort of nationalize production.
Right.
So he got it from both sides. I'm kind of shocked that he chose this side, but he liked the idea of being a pro-war socialist, and that's what he was.
Did he like the idea because, are you suggesting there was a kind of personal satisfaction that, he was an iconoclast within American society, but now he's an iconoclast within the iconoclasts,
exactly.
So it even makes him...
Okay. He was never a really foot soldier within the socialist movement.
Yeah.
He didn't really go to meetings of the socialist party. He wasn't involved in intra-party debates. He was, you've put it beautifully. Yes, I would agree. Okay. Like sometimes Bill Maher today, who I watch, loves to take contrarian positions against what he would call politically correct,
truism. Orthodoxy, right.
Yeah.
One of the things that happens in this World War One era is that it's kind of ironic, given what you just mentioned about his second wife's desire to kind of get away from his Eastern roots and his son, is that after the war, he spent roughly 18 months with David, his son, kind of uninterrupted. Yet they had a rocky relationship, an uneasy relationship. Can you talk about what the relationship between David and his father was like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes I've been accused of being too much of a fan of Upton Sinclair and not critical enough. So I, after studying his life, I would say that the one place I would be critical of is his relationship to David. Because I kind of took David's side in it as I looked at it. I just feel that he did abandon him too much.
Mm-hmm.
David, I think, was a reminder of his mother, of Mita. He may have looked like his mother, acted like his mother. I think that the Sinclairs in his new marriage really didn't want that reminder. I think Mary Craig really didn't like David. And in that way, he was very influenced to not continue the close relationship he'd had until David was about 12 when he got together with Mary Craig. He'd actually had him in a lot of, boarding schools even before he got with Mary Craig.
Mm-hmm.
Progressive boarding schools, but nonetheless boarding schools. I think that he, most people feel a tension between, writing and being a parent. And, he chose his writing over his parental identity.
Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting parts of the book was your description of, and again, I think this is something that people probably don't know very much about, if anything, is his governor's race in 1934, when he wins as a socialist, although he repudiates his Socialist Party membership, joins the Democratic Party, but he won the Democratic nomination for the governorship of California in 1934.
And, it wasn't that easy to do. You're right.
Right.
It's astonishing. I think he got more votes than all the other candidates put together. In a state where the Republicans had enjoyed complete domination. So there were, obviously the Democrats were dying to get in there, and there were many more mainstream Democrats that really probably thought they should have been the standard bearer rather than Upton Sinclair, the former socialist.
Yeah. Now, you're going to help me out here, because in my notes I have down that the title of his campaign was the EPIC campaign in capitals, EPIC. Mm-hmm. What did that mean? And
poverty in California.
Okay. What was he going to do? What was his campaign promise? How was he going to end poverty in California?
So he wrote a beautiful book called, This Is What the Future is Going to Be Like Once I've Won This Election. So he painted a portrait of... you can really only understand his campaign if you understand what the Depression had done to California, the extent of unemployment, the extent of empty factories that were abandoned, fields where oranges were being burned, as John Steinbeck described it, so that the cost would be higher. They were burning the extra crops. California was, tottering on complete disaster in a way that was unprecedented. So he basically said, we're going to put people in these factories. We're going to put people in these fields. We're going to produce what we need. We're going to have a system of barter, somewhat similar to co-ops. We're going to have something called scrip, which is something that, has now been accepted. He proposed many things, which the New Deal later did.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he... what he did was, at the most simple, is to say the government will create jobs, which is what, the New Deal did. The government will create jobs. The government will, there's lots of things that need to be fixed in California. We'll pay you to fix them. If actors need work, we'll pay you to make movies. Where was the money going to come from? Well, I guess the usual way, they were going to tax profits mm-hmm. much more... drastically than had been done up to then. They were going to probably tax the rich and have a limit on how much money anybody could make. So the very wealthy were very, very threatened by this. And as you know, there was kind of a conspiracy to undermine him, put together by Louis B. Mayer and the Orange mm-hmm. Growers Association and the LA Times. And they made a series of scurrilous newsreels that were shown. People stood up in the theaters and complained and objected because everything he said was being distorted. They'd take comments from characters in his novels and flash them on the LA Times as though this is what he said. And particularly, he was pilloried for being for free love, which is really ironic because he was the most faithful of husbands. He specifically had condemned promiscuity among the left and among the writers' community as being very self-destructive. But nonetheless, because it was in some of his books and because some of his early writings pre-marriage, before his first marriage or maybe during it, were not condemning or maybe saying that free love was something that should be explored. Anyway, he was really pilloried mm-hmm. with quotes from his books. And
he didn't do badly, though, right? I mean, he got, 900,000 votes?
Yes,
is that right? And I think his opponent got 1 million?
He almost won.
Yeah.
He almost won, despite the fact that all the major newspapers were against him. You wanted me to talk about his wealthy supporters. I'd really like to do that, because Elaine
sure.
Barnsdall, an oil heiress, was one of his main supporters during the campaign. But earlier, yes, he was fascinated with the way that wealthy heirs often became humanitarians and sometimes even socialists. People like Gaylord Wilshire in L.A., who founded a socialist mine and produced a socialist newspaper. He wrote about these characters. They were often the heroes of his books, like oil. Was about a very young man of wealth who learned about the world as looking at through the eyes of being an oil man's son. The Lanny Budd books, the World's End books, were about the son of an arms manufacturer. So I think he was fascinated with the dilemma of educated people of conscience especially heirs to great fortunes, mm-hmm. and, you know, mm-hmm. what should they do if they saw the world as it was and wanted to change things? So he befriended some of those people and then used them as models for characters in his books.
Just as he did with, you know, World War One, looking around and being aware of the international situation, you know, after the governor's race failed, he was a witness to the rise of fascism in Europe.
Yeah.
How did he respond to the rise of Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, and others?
He was a lot more concerned about it than most Americans. It's interesting, isn't it? Because after World War One, he, in a sense, became an isolationist along with the rest of America. He was bitterly mm-hmm. regretted his support of the war, hated the violations of civil liberties that ensued. But with World War Two, he was very, very, very concerned by the late 30s. About what was happening, and he decided that I think it was after Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia, and his wife said, our world's come to an end. Mm-hmm. And he paced in his garden, came up with this idea that somehow, if he could write a book about how the Nazis had come to power, if he could write a book that had a hero that was so irresistible that people would read it, they would just devour it like a Harry Potter novel or like a John Grisham novel. And they would be led along so well that they would, you know, in the end, be dying to fight Hitler, because Roosevelt really needed a population that was dying to fight Hitler, and he did not mm-hmm. have that in the America of the late 30s. So the first book, called World's End, was published in 1940. It was a huge bestseller. I think he was very effective in persuading the American population that the right thing to do and the necessary thing to do was to enter the war.
Did he ever feel any, I guess guilt is the wrong word, but did he ever feel any chagrin that, in a sense, he was going back to his old original career as a writer of popular fiction? Right? And, you know, here he's having this tremendous influence. I mean, it's for one of these books, right, Dragon's Teeth, that he ends up winning the Pulitzer Prize?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's a very thoughtful comment that you're making. You know, I love these books. I think they're very well written. I wouldn't call them hack writing, but, you know, they're...
No, but as a popular writer.
I think he probably... you know, once The Jungle had so much impact, I guess he didn't feel so bad about writing books that were popular. You know, writing books that were popular also means that they're well-read and they're, you know, they're going to accomplish something.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that the hack writing was a different thing. I think he liked being a writer of popular fiction very, very much. But he hadn't really found his groove, so to speak, until he did the World's End books.
Yeah.
They're one of his most significant accomplishments. Absolutely.
So who is Lanny Budd?
Well, anybody who's read the books never forgets Lanny Budd. He starts off, when the books start, the first book, he's about 13, 14. As I said, his father is an arms manufacturer. His mother is a very beautiful and very sought-after woman in the salons of Europe. So he's privy to all kinds of things. He's kind of like mm-hmm. every man. He's like a Zelig-like character that manages to stumble into, you know, Mussolini's inner circle, Hitler's inner circle, you know, knows the British fascists, meets communists in Italy, France, Germany, etc. It's sort of, you know, the American in Europe thing, which I know you've explored in your own work. And the mm-hmm, books are set entirely in Europe. And I think that's really a fascinating aspect. It's the only things that Sinclair wrote that I can really think of that, you know, weren't American novels. They're all in Europe. And you know, for Americans, this is like a real vicarious delight to be seeing this action hero who's also very sensitive and has, you know, many love affairs. you know, eventually goes undercover and becomes part of Hitler's inner circle, all the while acting as a spy for Roosevelt. I hope I'm not giving too much away. But if you read...
Well, there's four books. So
yeah, there's 11 novels, and eventually that's where he gets to. And, you know, I think he invented the spy drama, or reinvented it, or created the anti-fascist spy novel with this series.
Right. I when I was thinking of his personality, I couldn't help but think of the line from, forgive me here, Austin Powers, which is that women want him and men want to be him.
Mm-hmm.
Sounded like what he was like.
It's very apt.
Anyway, after the war, and with the advent of the Cold War, Sinclair becomes a pretty avid anti-communist. What was his orientation towards, American foreign policy in the Cold War era?
Well, that's something that I struggle to understand. Very similar to the World War I, where it kind of seems so counterintuitive. You know, having been this staunch socialist his whole life, was he really going to become an anti-communist?
Yeah.
There's some reasons for it, partly having to do with his experience with Eisenstein and the filming of Thunder Over Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
He was vilified by the American Communist Party for the way that whole misadventure turned out. He was vilified by the American Communist Party for running as a Democrat in the governor's race.
Mm-hmm.
He and his wife felt personally, they had a lot of animosity toward the American Communist Party. So when the official government policy became so anti-communist, I think it was rather easy for them, as at that time, quite elderly people, to just kind of slip right into it.
Yeah.
So he did not defy the McCarthy era at all, like you might have expected. But at that point, he was in his 80s.
Yeah. He also, one of the other interesting things about his later years was you suggest that he felt, in a sense, vindicated by, the Great Society programs,
mm-hmm.
and other anti-poverty movements of the late 60s, early 70s, that, even though the United States had not become a socialist country, yet it had realized a lot of his what he wanted to see happen. How vindicated do you think he felt, and how satisfied was he in the direction of American society, at least it's in terms of its social welfare direction?
Totally satisfied.
Not so much civil rights in the late 60s, early 70s.
I think he was thrilled. It's been left to later historians like you and me to rethink the Great Society of LBJ, and to realize that was a very ambitious attempt to try to keep the New Deal going. When I was coming of age, we had had contempt for Lyndon Johnson, but Robert Caro's work has forced me, and I know many other people, to reevaluate his success.
Right.
Sinclair was a huge fan of Lyndon Johnson and what he accomplished. He did feel like major change had happened. He was not concerned about the direction of American society. That's not to say he wouldn't be appalled by what's happened since. But
right.
in 1955, it seemed pretty good.
Well, you kind of anticipate my last substantive question for you, and that was, I guess one question for any biographer has to be, how is your subject, Upton Sinclair, what do you think, how is he meaningful for us today?
I think that the issues that we find ourselves confronting, whether they're civil liberties or food safety, the existence of labor unions, corporatization of higher education and K-12 system for that matter, it's almost surprising how relevant he is. I wouldn't have expected that we would be where we are right now. I think he's really relevant.
Okay. So we've taken almost an hour of your time up. So the last thing I'd like to ask you to expand on is, what's next for you?
I'm not sure what I'm going to do next, quite honestly.
You can't stop here.
I have a lot of ideas, but I don't have a big current project.
Okay. Well, it's nice to have an open horizon then. So the world is your oyster. Well, Lauren Coodley, I want to thank you so much for joining us at New Books in American Studies.
You're a great interviewer. I really enjoyed
so much.
Talking to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was our pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye.
So my name is Dan Kilbride, and we've been talking with Lauren Coodley, the author of Upton Sinclair, California Socialist, Celebrity Intellectual, published in 2013 by the University of Nebraska Press. And if you're on the New Books site and you see the little blurb about this interview, you know that there's a small icon of the book. And if you click on it, that'll take you right to the Amazon page. And we encourage you to buy the book, because not only will some of that cash go to Lauren Coodley, but a little bit of it will go to the New Books site to keep us running. So once again, my name is Dan Kilbride, host of New Books in American Studies. And we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.